Good morning. You're listening to WILL Urbana. This is Focus 580, our call-in program. I'm Todd Gleason, sitting in today for David Inge, who's away. Our guests this morning for Focus, and your calls are encouraged, to Robert Thompson. He's the Gardner Endowed Chair for Agricultural Policy here at the University of Illinois. Our topic, ag policy, of course, and what's been happening in Washington, D.C. over the last several months, including what the House has been up to. The Senate is just about to start talking, really, about ag policy as a floor debate. And there is a whole lot going on the world stage as well. Dr. Thompson, we appreciate you being with us this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. I always enjoy Focus 580.
Well, let's talk a little bit about policy. It's busy in Washington, D.C. this week. Where do we stand at this point on farm policy as they look to rewrite the 2002 version of that legislation?
Well, the debate has, of course, been going on actively for close to 2 years among all the farm organizations and commodity groups. The House of Representatives passed its farm bill in late July, and the Senate Committee on Agriculture is trying to get organized to write the farm bill. There are still quite a few different concepts floating around in that committee, so and probably until they get that organized, they won't actually go forward with the bill. But I'm guessing somewhere around Columbus Day, we ought to see the Senate Ag Committee function. Maybe get it through the floor of the Senate by the end of October, more likely November, and on the president's desk for signature before Christmas is my time frame.
Let's start at the very beginning with the Farm Bill to get some historical perspective. When was the Farm Bill legislation first put in place? And it's actually reauthorized each time that it comes up, isn't it?
Well, 1933 is when we started farm bills in the United States. Farm family income was 40% less than the incomes of non-farm people in the depths of the Depression. And, of course, the incomes of non-farm people weren't very good. So we put in place the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933 to try and give some income assistance to struggling farmers who were, in many cases, losing their farms because of the Depression.
And then from that point forward, we just keep reauthorizing it in different forms?
Keep revising it, although some of the critics assert that we haven't made nearly as much change in farm policy in the United States since the 1930s as the changes that have occurred in the farm sector. For example, farm family income and farm family wealth on average are substantially higher than those in the non-farm public. So at least in terms of income need, it's pretty hard to justify farm programs on that criterion.
How has it changed over the decades?
Well, we started out initially with the government buying up commodities, mostly wheat and cotton at the very beginning, to support the price. But any time the government got in the position of buying commodity and storing it in order to raise the price. Of course, when they released those stocks, it dropped the price. But also the inventories tended to grow and grow and grow until it just became so burdensome to cost to store them that they simply got out of it. Then we started paying farmers to take land out of production to reduce the risk of the overproduction that was associated with the price supports. And most recently, we support the prices at above what they otherwise would be. But then, farmers are told to sell it all on the market effectively, and then the government pays the farmer the difference between the guaranteed price and whatever the world market price drops to as a result of selling those stocks. But most recently, of course, with the ethanol boom, commodity prices are high, well above the prices that would trigger government program payments. And so in some senses, the payments are in the background as a safety net that would only be activated if commodity prices dropped again.
Ethanol really changes the landscape, I take, for this farm bill debate?
There are probably two factors that really changed the landscape. One is the ethanol boom and the high commodity prices that followed, and the other is the budget constraint. This Congress has adopted a pay-as-you-go policy. And when the Congressional Budget Office did its annual update in March of what the cost of the federal government would be for the next decade if no laws were changed in that period, the cost of the farm programs dropped by a little more than half. But under the pay-as-you-go policy, this became the new budget constraint. So in effect, the ag committees have less than half as much money to work with as we've been spending for farm programs.
For farm programs, but the farm bill covers far more than simple farm programs for farmers.
The farm bill covers or basically provides the authorizing legislation for everything the Department of Agriculture does. Food stamps is the biggest item in there, over $50 billion a year out of the department's $125 billion a year budget. But research, conservation, trade promotion, forestry, the whole range of things that the USDA gets involved in are authorized under the farm bills. And without authorizing legislation, the programs can't continue. So it is important after each five-year cycle of the farm bill that it be renewed just to authorize the programs that so many Americans enjoy.
How did the farm bill come to be on a five-year cycle? Do you know?
I frankly don't know the history of that. There's been the occasional farm bill that was 6 or 7 years. But 5 years is pretty much seems to be the norm. But I have no idea how we get into that cycle.
It's just one of those things I wondered about. And we used to always, when we had the Soviet Union, we'd talk about the five-year plan from them as well. So I don't want to cast any aspersions anyplace, but I've just wondered whether how that happened to come about. So when we look at Washington, D.C. and the Senate debate that's about to happen, it seems to me that in Washington, in the Midwest, in the South, where the farm bill is really being talked about in the northern part of the Midwest, that this farm bill is less done than any in recent memory for me, back to maybe the 1985 bill, which is the first one I can really recall being involved in some way.
Yeah, and the 1985 farm bill is the one I worked on when I was Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in the mid-80s. I think you're right that this farm bill is less done, as you say, than most for the point that we're at in the year. There's been an unprecedented number and diversity of groups engaged in this farm bill debate. You know, farm organizations like the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, commodity groups like those representing corn, soybean, wheat growers have always been really active players in working with the agriculture committees of Congress to write the legislation and revise it. But this time we've got a really unbelievable diversity of groups from very right-wing think tanks, taxpayers' associations, all the way to fairly left-leaning think tanks and advocacy groups as well, basically all saying that the farm bill is broken, or farm policy is broken, and needs to be changed. There's been an unprecedented flow of adverse media coverage and editorial comment across the newspapers of the country from coast to coast. But when the House of Representatives wrote its farm bill, all those other groups had no impact whatsoever. Only the farm organizations and commodity groups influenced the what came out of the House Ag Committee.
And consequently, the House bill looks a lot like the 2002 farm bill, and it was passed out of the House in July.
Most of the farm organizations initially advocated just extending the 2002 farm bill unchanged. They thought it was working very, very well. But of course, what happened was the prices of commodities rose, and all of a sudden the commodity groups realized they were not going to get much of any benefit out of the 2002 farm programs if they were just extended unchanged. So they started looking around, and one of the concepts they came up with was some form of a revenue insurance program. Others have advocated putting more of the money into conservation, because, of course, we have to conserve our soil and our water, the most fundamental resources in which agriculture is based. Others have said we ought to invest some of the money we're spending on farm programs in rural America in improving the infrastructure, getting broadband internet access to all rural Americans, improving the access to medical care, improving infrastructure. We all know that we've got problems with the locks and dams in the Mississippi that need remedying. But there's only so many dollars that are going to flow to rural America. And so the big question is, how much of the dollars that flow to rural America are going to be spent on payments directly to individual farmers, and how much is going to go into, you might say, social investments for the greater good of rural America?
We're talking to Bob Thompson this morning. He is the Gardner Chair of Agricultural Policy on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois this morning. Talking about ag policy, listeners, you're urged to join us. If you'd like, the phone numbers to call are locally 217-333-9455 or toll-free if you're out of that area code at 800-222-9455. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting patiently on line one from Urbana. Good morning to you, line one. Do you have a question or a comment?
I have a couple of things I was hoping that your guest could address. The first is I've been doing a little reading about high fructose corn syrup lately and its contribution to the diabetes and obesity epidemics, and wondering about how the higher price of corn due to the ethanol phenomenon might affect that, and if we might start seeing more regular sugar in our products as opposed to high fructose corn syrup, which sounds like it's pretty bad stuff. And then the second thing was I was wondering what changes might be made to the farm bill that might encourage more local food production. I was reading a Nation article recently that said that $1 spent on local food production leads to $5 in the local economy, as opposed to when people buy food that's shipped in from California or Ecuador or wherever. So anyway, I will hang up and listen to your comments on the radio.
Thank you much. A couple of good questions. Which order do you want to take them up?
I'll take the HFCS first.
Okay.
The high fructose corn sweetener development really got underway in a big way back in the 1980s. The United States has always had quite a protectionist policy with respect to sugar. And back at that time, we were supporting the domestic price of sugar as a result of the lobbying by the sugar growers. We were supporting the domestic price at 4 to 6 times the world market price. This provided an umbrella under which a lot of research got done to try and find alternative sweeteners that could replace sugar in the U.S. economy. As we all know, quite a bit of our candy industry moved to Canada and other countries because they were having to pay so much more than the world price for sugar. But the whole high fructose corn sweetener phenomenon occurred because of our sugar program that made it profitable to develop substitutes. And before that time, soft drinks were the single largest user of sucrose in the United States. And when HFCS came in, it replaced 100% of the sucrose going into soft drinks or non-diet soft drinks. So basically, you can thank the sugar price support program for providing the opportunity for HFCS to be developed. Now, of course, the soft drink industry likes the high fructose corn sweetener a lot because it is a liquid. It's easy to back a tank car of HFCS up next to the bottling plant and let it flow out into their blending, whereas you've got to dissolve crystalline sugar. So the soft drink industry in particular loves it. I think if we reformed our sugar program, it would be a lot less attractive to use HFCS over sucrose, and of course also with the higher price of corn that's occurred as a result of the ethanol boom, HFCS is becoming a lot less attractive alternative to sugar.
And we do have to reform the sugar program at some time, I think, don't we, by January 1st of 2008?
Something has to change. Most people that I know think that the North American Free Trade Agreement was fully implemented already. It hasn't been. The last steps occur on January 1, 2008, and one of the last steps is that Mexico will get completely free and unlimited access to the U.S. market for sugar. And the current sugar program will become untenable or unsustainable at that time. It'll basically would collapse under its own weight. Now, the House of Representatives took a very interesting approach to how we'd take care of that inflow of sugar and protect the existing price support program for sugar. They ordered the U.S. government to make ethanol out of any excess sugar that comes in as a result of opening up the sugar market. Now, that would be an extremely inefficient process. First, you got to dissolve the crystalline sugar, then ferment it and produce alcohol out of it. But that's the House of Representatives' approach to the problem that will be created by more Mexican sugar coming in. It'll be interesting to see what the Senate does on that issue.
Well, the sugar program, which sparked the idea that the high fructose corn syrup would be used in these products, will need to be changed because it will cost the government so much money.
Exactly, correct? Because the government guarantees a price that's well above the international market price. And so this will be very attractive to ship sugar in from Mexico, and the government will buy it right up.
And then for the high fructose side, is there a tax incentive, or is there an incentive of some sort for the bottlers to use high fructose corn syrup, or was it just more competitive because of the sugar program?
Oh, it was simply more competitive because of the sugar program. In effect, our price support program of sugar priced sucrose out of the market for soft drink production.
And do you know of any work that if sugar comes back into the country and we have lower sugar prices, is it likely to compete at a point at which they'll be willing to go ahead and take that crystalline sugar?
I think the price has to become very, very attractive before that'll happen, because the soft drink bottlers find it much easier to handle a liquid form of sweetener rather than crystalline. As I said, it's just easy to pull a tank car of HFCS up next to your bottling plant, hitch up a hose, and blend the liquids.
Let's take up the second question from our caller, which is about local food production and what might be put into the Farm Bill, or what the debate might be in Washington.
There is a strong movement for community farmers markets that's providing the opportunity for a limited number of small to medium-sized family farmers to earn a lot more income by producing products that local people want to buy. So it's a very good income-earning opportunity for a limited number of people, but it's not the mass market. There still is a very substantial part of the American population, and certainly the world population, that buys their food on the basis of price. And anybody that shops very often at the local farmers markets knows that the prices are higher for very good, often superior produce. But the whole local food consumption movement that's afoot, I think, misses one very important point, and that is that different agroecological regions have different comparative advantages in producing different products. And if you try to be self-sufficient in everything within 15 or even 50 miles from home, you would probably end up causing a lot of soil erosion, a lot of degradation of the natural resources, because we would simply be producing some of the wrong things in the wrong places. So we actually might increase the environmental damage if we tried to be self-sufficient in everything real close to home. What comparative advantage is all about is letting each region specialize in what they do best, and then exchanging that for what other places do better. And that doesn't detract at all from a limited clientele, generally higher than average income clientele, enjoying the local farmers markets. And as I say, some farm families are having the opportunity to earn a lot better income by producing produce for those markets. But we'd be in trouble if we tried to produce everything locally.
We have another caller. He is on line one as well, from Champaign this morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do that as well, 333-9455 locally, or 800-222-9455. Good morning to our Champaign caller. You have a question for Dr. Thompson this morning?
Yes, I do.
And go ahead.
I have read and I have looked at all the labels in the grocery stores that practically everything you pick up has got high fructose corn syrup in it as a sweetener. I've also read that one of the causes for obesity is the prevalence of this high fructose corn syrup. The reason is, according to what I've read, is that the body does not recognize the corn syrup sugar as a true sugar, and therefore it gets transferred into the body as fat, and that would be completely detrimental. And I myself steer away from all of that corn syrup sweetener. Make a comment on that, please.
Well, my reaction is that any food product that contains high fructose corn sweetener would probably contain sucrose if it didn't contain HFCS, and certainly if a body takes in too much sugar or too many calories from anything, whether it's sugar or any other carbohydrate, the body converts it into fat. So in that sense, I think you're being a little bit unjust to high fructose corn sweetener, because if you had the same degree of sweetness in the product as a result of sucrose, and you consume more calories than you burn in a given day, as a result of your physical activity, you'll gain weight. Any sweetener or any excess of calories above what the body uses will be converted into fat. So, in that sense, I think it's simply a case of excess caloric intake relative to utilization from any source.
Let's talk a little bit more about farm policy out of Washington, D.C. What are the farm policy debates looking like for the Senate? Are they lining up geographically? Are they lining up in some form that we haven't seen before? How are those who are planning to put farm policy forward next week getting things done?
Well, we have to start with the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Tom Harkin, from the state of Iowa. He's always been a champion of conservation, and he would like to put more money into conservation. He also is a strong advocate of the disadvantaged, and would probably put more money into food stamps and other food assistance programs. He has talked about some kind of a revenue assurance program as promoted by the corn growers at times, as one possible alternative to the present structure of our farm commodity programs. But Senator Harkin's perspectives on the Farm Bill are not the only perspective on his committee. He also has the ranking Republican, former Chairman Chambliss from Georgia, who is standing up strong for continuing the 2002 level of, or 2002 Farm Bill level of supports, particularly to cotton and rice, the two most subsidized commodities. He and Senator Conrad from North Dakota, a state which has quite variable climatic conditions and as a result highly variable yields and a more frequent incidence of crop failures than many other states in the country. Senators Cochran and Conrad and Chambliss are working hard to create a permanent disaster program that give the Secretary of Agriculture standby authority to make disaster payments when there is a crop failure, and Chambliss to continue the present level of supports for the basic commodities and particularly those of the South. On top of that, our own senior Senator Durbin, together with junior senator from Ohio Brown, have been promoting a revenue insurance program that as an alternative to our present structure of farm programs. Basically, the argument is that it isn't price, it isn't yield that's the problem. It's when income falls short in a farm family that you really have the problems. And so they're proposing a revenue insurance alternative that would pay out to farmers when income, price times yield, drops below some trigger level. And we know that farming is an inherently risky business with crop yields subject to variable weather conditions and commodity prices often being very volatile and unpredictable. And Senator Lugar from Indiana has also expressed some interest in some form of revenue insurance program. Now, on top of all of this, we have the small problem of the budget constraint. The Congressional Budget Office projected that the cost of the current farm programs, if extended unchanged, would drop by over half in this next farm bill. And under the pay-as-you-go budgeting system of the current Congress, that meant that the available money for our farm programs dropped by over half. Now, if they want to get more money, they have to get authority from the Ways and Means Committee in the House and from the Senate Finance Committee on the Senate side. Well, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee is Senator Baucus from Montana, who also has commodity producers who enjoy farm programs. And Senator Baucus says, yeah, I could probably come up with maybe even $10 billion more for farm programs, but I'm going to tell you how it has to be spent. So you've got sort of a three-ring circus going on with Harkin in one ring, Durbin Brown, Conrad and Chambliss in a second, Durbin Brown and the other revenue assurance programs in a third. And over all of this, overarching all of this, you've got the budget constraint, which is pretty much controlled by Baucus.
That should make for an awfully interesting week, this week and next week, I would think, in Washington, D.C., wouldn't it?
Personally, I'm not betting on anything happening till after Columbus Day.
We've got several folks that are waiting patiently to be online. We'll get to them in a moment. Farmers will look at this, and they probably will want to know how these impact their bottom line. Are there places that they can go to see how they stack up against each other, what's been passed and how they stack up?
Yes, some of my colleagues in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics have put together a small simulator that's available on their FarmDoc website. That's www.farmdoc.uiuc.edu. And it will allow producers here in the Eastern Corn Belt or Central and Eastern Corn Belt to simulate how their farm might fare under some of the alternatives that have been proposed.
And I think at the moment it shows the House Farm Bill and then Senator Durbin and Senator Brown Farm Bill.
Exactly,
proposal.
But as other options become more well defined, if they do, they'll keep that up to date.
Line number two from Urbana has been waiting very patiently. Thanks for your patience this morning as we talk about farm policy and agriculture. Do you have a question that you'd like to ask Bob Thompson this morning? And that would be line two.
Yes, and I realize this is probably peripheral, but back to the fructose.
Uh-huh.
It is the sugar found in all fruits, right?
Fructose is the sugar that's in fruits, yes.
And then why is orange juice desirable, but soft drinks made with it undesirable, other than the fact, of course, that the soft drinks are nutritionally not very desirable, having no value other than the sugar, nutritional value?
Well, orange juice, of course, is a major source of vitamin C, in particular, and so it's the if the only reason you were drinking orange juice was to get some form of sugar, you probably wouldn't have the same. You couldn't make the argument for it. But nutritionally, fruits are major suppliers of vitamins and minerals, and that's exactly why another of the objectives of this farm bill is to encourage greater consumption of fruits and vegetables in the United States, in our school lunch programs, as well as in the public more generally. So our the farm bill is very very strongly advocating more fruit and vegetable consumption.
We also have a caller from Urbana on line one this morning. Good morning to you, line one.
Is it my turn?
Yes, it is.
I'm very, I think it's a big mystery to me that you can make sugar out of corn. How does that conversion take place?
Well, I'm not a chemist, so I certainly can't give you a very detailed explanation. So I'm afraid I have to punt on that question. But basically, any cereal grain has carbohydrates in it, which are composed of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and the same components of sugar. And so through a transformation process, the HFCS production facilities convert one form of carbohydrate into another. But that's as far as I can go. You have to consult somebody more technically competent in chemistry than I.
And on line four, waiting patiently on the toll-free line in Indiana, we have a call as well. Good morning to you.
Hello.
Yes.
I know that the interconnections in the farm bill and the manufacturers and the world and all that is pretty dense. But the simulator model you have on the website, would it accept no help at all to the farmer and see what would happen? I've often wondered about that. I remember they used to talk about that back in the 50s, what the dire consequences would be, particularly when we were talking about free trade and stuff like that. I just wondered, I know it's not a possibility, but would it be such a dire thing to happen if we just jerk these programs out and say you're on your own like the rest of us?
Well, first, this simulator is designed to look at specific alternatives that are being proposed in this farm bill debate. So you're right, it would not be able to show the option of what would happen with no support. But there have been a number of studies done by agricultural economists over the years. One of the things that would happen is probably land prices in significant parts of the country would fall, except in areas close to major metropolitan areas where you have development possibilities for the farmland, say to grow houses instead of corn. You have quite a bit of capitalized value farm program payments in the rest of the country in those land prices. And so you take the payments away, land prices would probably drop somewhat more the further you are from development potential. Mm-hmm. Probably the other thing that I think is most restrictive about the present farm programs is if you've historically produced the main supported commodities, corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, and cotton, a farmer pretty much can't afford not to keep producing those commodities. So in some senses, our farm programs are barriers to entrepreneurship. And in fact, there's an explicit ban on producing fruits and vegetables on land that receives direct payments under the major commodity programs. That's another issue that's being considered in this farm bill. So in some ways, the current farm policy impedes farmers from adjusting to move resources to from what's being supported by the government into producing other commodities for which there may be a greater market demand.
And the problem with reducing those farm subsidies and potential loss in the value of asset in the land works its way back in through the rest of the economy, through both, I think, the school systems and the banking system.
Well, in particular, the way we support our local schools in the United States based on local land taxation, the capitalized value of those farm program payments in land prices has provided greater tax revenue to support local schools and roads.
And then the banking system as well because of the assets that are borrowed on?
Farmers have to be able to repay their loans, so cash flow is affected. But more importantly, if the bank has lent money to buy the land on the basis of the previous market price that had the effect of the farm programs built in, and you take the programs away, somebody's pretty heavily leveraged could end up with the value of their collateral being less than or being reduced, and as a result, the bank would want more collateral against the loan or call the loan.
We have someone on line three waiting in Stewartson, Illinois, this morning to talk to you. Good morning to you, line three.
Yes, hello. Back to the fructose. Corn syrup. I heard, and I'd already tried not to take things that had corn syrup in it, and I don't. So I quit drinking sodas and everything. But also then I heard from somebody that had diabetes that that the corn syrup somehow turns off your whatever your feeling that you're full, and so you just keep eating even though you've already eaten enough food. I don't know if that's true or not. I just took them as their word, but I never researched it. Does anybody know that? And then there's one more thing. I wanted to the guy that said, they said that, oh, maybe farmers should just be on their own. I always assume that there's always some type of a farm bill because everybody has to eat, and a lot of things are the farmer has, there has to be production. And what if all the farmers just said, okay, we aren't going to grow anything, then there would be chaos. I always thought it was for some control. Is that anywhere on the ballpark?
Well, first on the HFCS, I'm an economist, not a chemist or a human physiologist, and I simply have no idea how to respond to your first question. But on the issue of U.S. food security and the role farm programs play in it, we have the most amazingly productive agriculture in the world with our wonderful fertile soils in the Midwest, probably the best on the planet, favorable climatic conditions, and an accumulated stock of research results that give us productivity in excess of that enjoyed by any other country. As a result, we export the production of 1 out of every 3 acres of land in the United States. So we are in no sense in danger of running out of food. But when you add to that the reality that 60% of American agriculture gets no government support, none of the fruit and vegetable sector, for example, and none of animal agriculture except dairy, which doesn't enjoy very high levels of support. So the idea that we'd have a food security problem without farm programs is a real stretch. I just don't find that a credible argument at all.
Well, on that note, maybe we'd better take up what the administration has been pushing, because you talked about fruits and vegetables and the lack of support that they have had. And the administration has some ideas about redistribution of the dollars that go to farmers and producers of all kinds of commodities in the United States, don't they?
Well, in part in response to the lobbying by the nutrition community and the food advocates, there has been strong pressure to get encouragement for consumption of more fruits and vegetables by Americans into the Farm Bill. That's part of the background. As I mentioned before, in our present farm programs, there's a ban on producing fruits and vegetables on land that receives direct payments for corn, soybean, wheat, cotton, and rice production. And so in that sense, those programs provide some protection to fruit and vegetable industry because it limits the amount of competition that's out there. And the administration acknowledges that that protection, indirect protection that the fruit and vegetable growers have gotten has some value to them. And the administration proposed, I think it was $5 billion, not for price and income supports, but for research, for product promotion, to get more into the school lunch program, for programs that would protect fruit and vegetable growers against insect and other pest invasions, and export promotion of their products. That $5 billion was to be in exchange for giving up the fruit and vegetable exclusion. The House of Representatives Farm Bill puts about $1.5 billion in for that same type of program for the fruit and vegetable industry, but did not eliminate the fruit and vegetable exclusion. So clearly the message has gotten through that Americans need to be consuming more fruits and vegetables, that fruit and vegetable production needs to be encouraged, and therefore, there's going to be money in the next farm bill to help make it happen.
Yeah, but the compromise to begin with, and the reason the exclusion is there, is because the fruit and vegetable growers said, as long as the commodity growers in the Midwest don't start growing lettuce and fruits and vegetables on their properties, we don't want money from Washington, D.C. Put the ban in place and that's okay with us. Is that right?
It is, but also the fruit and vegetable industry has always taken the attitude, don't screw up our markets with government intervention and prices.
Indeed. Line 2 is joining us now from Champaign. Good morning to you, Line 2.
Hi. The gentleman earlier asked kind of a similar question as far as just taking all subsidies away.
Uh-huh.
Now, my understanding, and maybe you can shed light on it, is that the subsidies go to everyone, including the extremely large manufacturers that really don't need a lot of extra help. They're pretty profitable on their own, and yet we make them more profitable with these subsidies. Is there ever been a case where the question would be, should we take away those incentives there, allow the market to work with the larger corporations, and then just let subsidies work for the smaller farmer? And if so, how would that play out on an economic basis? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much. Who do the subsidies go to? Does it actually go to the farmer? Does it go to the landowner? Who does the subsidy go to? And then talk about who can get them, how big they can be and such.
Yeah, it's a very good question and one that's very timely in this farm bill debate. Back when we started subsidizing agriculture in 1933, average farm family incomes were about 40% less than average incomes of people in the rest of the economy. Most farmers were small, and there was a general perception we had to help the struggling small-scale family farmers survive. When the program was set up then, it was basically set up to distribute the benefits in proportion to sales. And because most farmers were about the same size, there was not a very pronounced difference in the benefits that different farmers got. But over a period of years, we've seen a significant growth in very large-scale agriculture, a lot of consolidation in farming. But our programs still, in general, distribute the benefits pretty much in proportion to sales. So the largest producers end up getting the largest benefits. And at the end of the day, the benefits get capitalized into the price of farmland. And so it's the largest farmland owners who end up with most of the long-term benefits of the farm programs. Now, over the years, over several decades, there's been debate, shouldn't we limit the payments going to the largest producers? And there have been attempts to put limitations on. During the time I was in the administration in the mid-80s, we had a $50,000 per farm payment limitation. Back in those days, only rice and cotton growers were hitting the payment limitation. Our corn and soybean growers really were always below that level. But with continuing consolidation and also some enrichment of the farm programs over the years, most producers of the supported commodities there are producers of most of the supported commodities that bump the payment limitation. The administration proposed in its farm bill alternative back in January to limit or basically to cut off farm program payments to anyone whose adjusted gross income on their 1040 income tax return exceeded $200,000. The House Ag Committee put $1 million in. Senator Harkin says he would aim for something in between. But because the rice and cotton growers tend to be the largest beneficiaries of farm programs and in many cases get millions of dollars a year in benefits, there's huge opposition to payment limitations from the South, and they'll work very hard to defeat any farm bill that comes out that restricts the amount of money. But it's a very good question. I just want to add one footnote. You said manufacturers and corporations in the context of your question. The payments go to farmers, to producers of commodities, not to those that manufacture them or process them into processed foods. And the other point, you mentioned corporations. Most well-organized, efficient family farms today are incorporated for tax planning and estate planning purposes. So there's a lot of mythology out there, out and about corporate agriculture, with the idea that corporate agribusiness or food companies are taking over farming. It's just not the case. There's very, very small amount of that. And most of the corporate farms are family farms. But it's just more efficient for tax and estate planning to have a corporate form of ownership rather than a partnership or a sole proprietorship.
And the corporate farms don't necessarily, I mean, that family farm that's incorporated isn't necessarily larger than the average
No.
Average farm. It's across the whole spectrum from small to large because it's a tax. It's the tax structure, not anything else that has caused them to be incorporated.
Exactly. So it has no correlation to size.
And that's one of the things that probably, hopefully, we can clear up very quickly, that incorporated or corporation means something entirely different when you're talking about the world of agriculture and farms. Line one is in Urbana and joins us now with a question. Good morning. Thanks for waiting patiently. We appreciate it. So you have a question for Bob Thompson this morning?
Indeed.
Okay.
The European Union has brought a complaint against the farm program tactics in the United States. And if the current program hasn't changed, I presume that the complaint will still persist. The European strategy in supporting agriculture apparently is preferred over the American strategy. Could you describe and talk about that problem, please?
Over the last several decades, there hasn't been that much difference in most of the period between the U.S. and the European Union. We have both supported the prices of agricultural commodities at quite a bit above the world market level. But over time, the U.S. really advocated first decoupling support to farmers from the production of specific commodities to base the support on some other criterion than production of a specific commodity, because that's what tended to create surpluses and distort the markets. We started the process back in 1985 and pretty well decoupled our support to agriculture from any specific commodity production. The Europeans eventually agreed with us, and they have pretty much gotten rid of price supports and have taken their total support in total, which exceeds the amount that U.S. spends on farm programs, but it's spread over a lot more farmers. But they took basically the same number of euros and divided by the number of acres of farm land. And they're providing a payment per acre of land to farmers without any regard for what the farmer grows on that land, but with the stipulation the farmer has to meet some pretty strict environmental and conservation requirements for how that land is managed. So today, European policy is probably preferable to ours because it is not distorting the farmer's decision of what he or she produces. And in fact, in some senses, in the 2002 Farm Bill, we took a step backwards, and the House Ag Committee or the House passed Farm Bill in July takes a step even further backwards in reconnecting more of our support to production of specific commodities. Now, the formal complaint against our programs was not lodged by the European Union, but by Brazil, and more recently by Canada. Brazil filed a case with the World Trade Organization against our cotton program and won. They also filed a case against the European Union sugar program and won. The difference there is the European Union immediately set in motion a reform of its sugar program, even though they have very powerful sugar lobby too, dropped the support price 34 cents a pound in 1 year, started buying out farmers and sugar beet processing plants. The U.S. also lost the case on cotton. We thumbed the nose at the rest of the world. So as a result, we are being criticized in a lot of parts of the world for our farm programs and are generally viewed as the problem in the current round of WTO agricultural trade negotiations.
One final question from our listeners, and then we'll wrap up at about 3 minutes or so, 3.5 minutes. So maybe we'll get a final comment from you as well, Dr. Thompson. Line three has been waiting very patiently in Champaign. Last caller for the morning. Good morning to you, line three. You have a question for us this morning?
Yeah, actually, I guess my concern with this emphasis on just the main crops and especially corn is the lack of rotation. It seems to me that they don't do the amount of rotation that's needed among the major crops. The other one is that it really is a sad commentary that in terms of the sugar industry, that they had so much power, and it still also remains in the, for what reason? It's the same way with the cotton industry. I mean, from my understanding, cotton is not a commodity that in the United States, it actually can be raised in other areas with. It takes a lot of water, I guess, and it's very difficult on the soil. Let's see, what was the other? It was cotton, and what's the other one?
Rice.
Rice is the same way. So any comments that you have? A good program.
Yeah. Quickly, the point about lack of rotation in corn, the ethanol program is driving farmers into really continuous corn production, and I think it'll exceed, or the impact on causing farmers to grow continuous corn will be much greater than the farm programs ever were. You're absolutely right. The sugar lobby is one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. I think sugar and dairy are right up there at the top of the list, along with national defense industries, as some of the most powerful lobbies in the federal government. They're the largest campaign contributors. In fact, you look at the levels of subsidies to different commodities, the ranking by the magnitude of the subsidies is just about exactly the same order as the magnitude of the political contributions to members of the Senate and House Agriculture Committee. The U.S. has no comparative advantage in sugar production. The humid tropics, the developing countries do, probably much the same in cotton as well as rice. But those are such powerful economic interests in Washington that they pretty much dominate the debate over both our ag policy as well as our trade policy.
Well, Dr. Thompson, we've come to the end of our time this morning. We appreciate your time and for you coming to the north end of campus from Mumford Hall this morning to talk about ag policy. Thanks for coming in. Any very short final word from you this morning?
Well, it's always a pleasure to be on the program. I do appreciate the calls, and we're not done with the Farm Bill yet. It's we've still got a very interesting couple of months ahead of us. And if they get into a stalemate in the Senate, we could even see a simple extension of the 2002 Farm Bill for 2 years to get it past the presidential election. And I think the same may very well happen with the WTO trade negotiations.
And we've been talking this morning with Robert Thompson, who's the Gardner Chair of Agricultural Policy in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences here on the Urbana-Champaign campus.